exact statistical mechanics. But before that, I believe you had lots of interesting discussions about issues of chemical potential for photon gas, why it is zero, and why for Bose gas with finite density, why chemical potential is large and negative at high temperature. So I will go back to this issue. And after finishing, we will come to interesting study of exact statistical mechanics, particularly a two-dimensional Ising model, which Ansager, in the early 1940s or late 1940s, solved it exactly. And it turns out there are later methods which are more easy to understand. Ansager's paper is a big paper. It involves lots of algebra, lots of study of matrices and Clifford algebra and so on. But without all those complications, we can understand the solution now. And interestingly, there are many, many papers on solution of 2D Ising model. One of the latest, which is already maybe 15 years ago, was by Baxter and a collaborator with the title 399th solution of Ising model. Just to say that there are so many ways to understand that. In fact, that particular paper is a very nice paper. If some of you are interested, you should look at it. So let's go to chemical potential. So the question is, why photon gas? It turns out it is to do with the conservation of number of particles, number of the particles that we are considering. So here we are considering corpuscles, that is photons, whose number, if you think a little bit about it, it's obvious that it's not conserved. If you think about a black body, we often talk about black body radiation. So radiation is only a subsystem. Photons are subsystems. Photons actually come from either atoms in the medium or atoms from the thermal bath. So there can be excited atoms which can emit radiation. Similarly, a quanta can be absorbed by an atom. And so there is a thermodynamic equilibrium between the atom and the electron subsystem and photons. And that's very clear when you look at the sun. Many things happen at the sun in the interior. We have millions of, the temperature is very high. But when you come to the surface, we have a very high temperature plasma. Atoms are ionized. Electrons are zooming around. They emit radiation. But at the end of the day, we have a nice equilibrium. And we see the visible radiation with a characteristic Planckian temperature of about 5,000 or 6,000 Kelvin. So we are hiding the subsystem, which are responsible for emission absorption of the radiation, and we are focusing on the radiation. So if I want to study this subsystem, according to Gibbs' prescription, the only control I have is energy density. In the case of classical gas or liquid that I'm considering, I have in the experimental situation a control over the density of the gas or the density of the liquid. So I have to put a Lagrange multiplier in addition to temperature, which is a Lagrange multiplier, which controls mean energy or mean internal energy. So that's why in the theory of the grand partition function for photons, you say that this fugacity is 1. That is, it doesn't give any importance to any particular number. And whereas this gives importance to this particular energy, which is appearing through KT. So the reason is as simple as that. And in fact, it is while worrying about this and not being able to understand chemical potential deeply, Einstein landed at his famous Bose-Einstein condensation. So because his derivation of Planck distribution did not involve Gibbsy and summing over states. It involved an equilibration between atoms which emit radiation and then which keep absorbing. So he studied the equilibrium between the two and then got Planck distribution where he had to fix the coefficients using limiting laws like Maxwell distribution and Stefan-Boltzmann law and so on. So S.N. Bose directly went into the ideas of microstates and did counting and got a Bose distribution function. And then it was immediately clear to Einstein how to discuss with the case in which the number of bosons is a fixed quantity. And interestingly, Einstein did not have any example in mind of a Bose system with a which has a finite density in the lab. So it was much later. It was London, F. London, who pointed out that helium-4 is the best non-relativistic boson you can imagine. Because there the two electrons are paired up. So that's like a boson. And then the nuclei has zero spin in helium-4. And when superfluidity was discovered, immediately London wrote a very nice paper elaborating it in terms of Bose-Einstein condensation, but in the presence of interaction. And the story is that somebody went and told Einstein that here is a proof for your Bose-Einstein condensation. And apparently he was not impressed. He said, it's obvious. So, and he was thinking about, of course, other things. So this is the statement about chemical potential for photon gas. And similar thing happens when you study phonons in a solid, like when you study specific heat, again by using Einstein's method. You have oscillators, namely atoms, which is sitting in some self-consistent potential provided by other atoms. So if you focus on this atom, you say that this is sitting in some kind of harmonic well and it's oscillating. And the number of phonon quanta corresponds to in which state this atom is. If it is in the ground state, the phonon is 0. If it is in the first excited, it is 1 quanta, 2 quanta, and so on. So we don't specify the total number. So when you do thermodynamics of this Einstein solid, we simply have so many oscillators. That, of course, is fixed. But then these oscillators can have 1 quanta, 2 quanta, and so on. So we don't specify the number. It is the energy which determines a mean number, not a chemical potential. So this is true for phonons, which is another example. OK. Is that clear? Mathematically, that's a very simple reason. Now I will go to Bose gas, which I apparently rushed through, the Bose condensation and so on. And I will show explicitly that I drew a picture that chemical potential for a given density of particle. This is very important. That is, you fix this. So you have so many, or you fix a specific volume. You say that the volume occupied by per particle is some number corresponding to some density. Then I drew a picture saying that for Bose-Einstein gas, it starts from a very large negative value, and then becomes 0 at a particular TC, and then remains flat. So what is this? And I did not draw a picture. And if you do the same thing for Fermi gas, what you find is an interesting behavior. Asymptotically, for a given same density, at large temperature, the Fermi gas, Bose gas, and Boltzmann gas all behave identical because quantum effects become more and more negligible. But however, in the case of Fermi gas, there is a temperature called Fermi temperature, which is simply related to Fermi energy, where Fermi energy is known. You know that. That is, you fill up to some momentum in k space for the ground state. So that defines the Fermi momentum. And h cross square kf square divided by 2m is the Fermi energy. So this is also something I did not derive. Now let me focus on this first before we go to Bose condensation. So what I did was, this is very simple that you have total number, n of k, plus or minus 1 for bosons or fermions. And we are going to consider very high temperature. So this Boltzmann factor is going to be, this factor is going to become very large. So you can approximate this by because for most of the values of k, and we will see self-consistently, mu is also negative and large. One can be ignored, and then you have this. And this sum can be performed because for non-relativistic particle, h cross square. So it's a very simple Gaussian integral. When you do that, you get an equation which involves mu and temperature and mass through this, and then n on the right side. So this is a fairly straightforward integral. I will not do it. I'll simply show the result that you get mu naught t. Do a subscript mu naught saying that it's like for classical gas, simply equal to kBT divided by the thermal wavelength that we had already discussed before. It's fairly straightforward. That is, you have, so this, when you convert it to integral, you have 4 pi k square dk times e to the power of minus so now pull this e to the power of mu out. So that is what will give you when you take log some mu factor. That's why you get log here. And then what you are left with is a very simple Gaussian integral involving some k square, which can be performed analytically for this. And then you get this form. So this is a standard result from classical Boltzmann gas in the grand canonical ensemble, which you get as a limit. So and you notice that since I have ignored this one, it doesn't matter whether you have a fermion or bosons. Now if you do it carefully for fermion without making this approximation, turns out you can do it in terms of special functions. And that's where you find that it starts being large and negative, and then it becomes positive. The positive chemical potential is very easy to understand because in order to inject an electron, for example, in a metal, you'll have to climb up to the Fermi energy and then put an electron. So it requires very large and positive energy to change the particle number. Physically, you are working against the Pauli pressure. Whereas, so that's called degenerate Fermi gas, when the energy is very small compared to this Fermi temperature, when the energy is very small and you are somewhere here. So this is what you normally come across, deal with in when you consider metal like copper or aluminum. But if you go to semiconductors, where you don't have carriers normally, and then you add some dopants and you create a small density of carriers, and you can have density so low, the Fermi temperature can be of the order of room temperature or even lower. So in that case, you say that your electron gas coming from dopants behaves like a classical gas. In fact, very often in semiconductor physics, when you study carrier dynamics, you make that approximation. You say it's like a Boltzmann gas. But as the density increases, quantum or Pauli principle starts coming in a big way, and many, many new things happen. OK. So this was about this large temperature region. Then I glossed over this low temperature region. So let me repeat that. Yes.
So regarding your picture there, so at t equal to 0, the mu is actually equal to epsilon f.
Exactly.
Right. So that tf over there, is it just a coincidence or?
No. There is a it's supposed to be, there is a physics which says that at that temperature, you have no distinction between. Let me recollect the physics and then tell. So it's not a coincidence. I mean, dimensionally, this is the only temperature scale you have. So it can be Tf or something proportional to Tf. Yes. Sorry, please repeat the question.
In the both, you go to the exponential beta times epsilon minus b plus minus 1 to the epsilon e to the minus beta epsilon minus b. So how do you do that?
This one. Yeah. So I'm doing it at high temperature because I anticipate that mu is larger negative. Suppose I assume that mu is going to be larger negative. Then this is plus. It's plus some positive quantity. And then epsilon k is always positive. H cross square k square by 2m. So this part is exponentially large.
But eta is also very, very small.
Yeah. I consider those factors which make, which is larger than beta.
But how can we guarantee that it is true? I mean, how do you know, before we do the calculation, how do you know that those are?
Oh, yeah. This is a mathematical analysis. You assume this and then do an analysis and you find it's consistent. So formally, you can evaluate this sum in terms of some special functions. Here, I am assuming that I anticipate a solution in which mu is negative. So this denominator is beta. And then the phase space is big. There are states whose energy is very large compared to kT. There are states whose energy is small compared to kT. And I am assuming that they are going to dominate and make an approximation. And then I can check later. So it's an analysis, approximate analysis. This is something that we repeatedly do in physics, that you make an assumption and then find some result and then check back. Yes, please.
Sorry, can you just repeat how you get that expression for mu of
t? Oh, this one. Oh, I have done it here. Let me do it. So I have gotten this simply by saying that there is n by v, we come, so this right side, right hand side will be 1 over 2 pi q 4 pi e to the power of let me put plus modulus. So this is the integral I have to evaluate. This is what I have evaluated. So fortunately, I can pull out this. Then I can introduce a variable x, which is dimensionless, and perform the integral. I have some constant. And the rest of the factors come in to give me this lambda. Okay. So now I will spend some time digressing about this, because this is something very important, which is, so there what I said was that when you, again, you take this equation, Einstein noticed that if you replace this summation by an integral like this, in his case, the integral will be something interesting happens. That is, mu continuously increasing, is continuously increases. And then a stage comes in which this equation cannot be satisfied below this particular point. So there he noticed that there is a problem here, because the k equal to 0 mode state of the helium atom has an energy epsilon k equal to 0. So when you look carefully, that has a form 1 over. So then in terms of fugacity, you can rewrite it as where z is e to the power of beta mu, which is what we want to do, plus this integral, which Einstein found in terms of some function, which is
Sorry? It's small v is volume per particle.
Volume per particle, exactly, yeah. V divided by n. Yeah, small v. So as you are solving the equation, as long as, so in particular, when you evaluate this g of 3 by 2 as a function of z, it starts like this. And then reaches value unity at a particular value here, which is 2.6 approximately. And z equal to 1 corresponds to mu going to 0. So until that point, this factor can be ignored because z is finite, is less than 1. So there is a volume factor, so this can be ignored. But once you reach this particular point, in which this g is growing, because if you plot, suppose you ignore this, then what you have is lambda cubed divided by v. So this is a volume, that is a de Broglie wavelength to the power of 3 divided by this specific volume, and g to the power of. Suppose you analyze this problem before that happens, then you always have a solution like, because this quantity depends on temperature, because lambda is square root of 2 pi square, something like this. This is a de Broglie wavelength. So as you increase the temperature, this, for a given density, we have fixed the density, this keeps going up. And then a point comes in which it becomes, everything is saturated by this term. Then Einstein noticed that, how do I interpret this now? Because this difference can become of the order of 1 over v square, the thermodynamic limit. In which case, it can become like v times some macroscopic number, number of particles. So what Einstein did was, so I will interpret this, go back to my original definition, and then consider this as number of bosons in zero momentum state, and then look at the rest. Sorry? Yes. So below TC, I have put the fugacity equal to 0. So the fugacity kept increasing, and then at TC it became 0. Then after that, I look for solutions in which fugacity is 0. The only way I can achieve that and get total number of particle, namely whatever I have given, is by saying that the first term, which I ignored before, is contributing to whatever is not able to come from here. So that is a zero momentum condensate. So I know the analytic form of this, and I know this. Then from this I can calculate. And if this n naught v, the capital, let me call it as capital n naught v, and then divided by v will be some small n naught. It is that which behaves like an order parameter. And TC is obtained by saying that when you hit this, that means lambda q, which is a function of t, and here there is this specific volume. This is equal to G of 3 by 2, 1, which is supposed to be zeta function at 3 by 2, which is approximately 2.6. So this equation, because we know lambda in terms of this de Broglie wavelength, gives you an expression for TC in terms of density or specific volume and some numbers, universal numbers. So this is what Einstein found. So Einstein did a careful job of this chemical potential analysis, that the first term which looked, which is negligible, suddenly becomes important when z reaches 1, because there is denominator is vanishing. So then I'll have to go back to the original definition of it and interpret it in terms of number of particles in zero momentum. And then my, if I go back to this original, so I satisfy this condition by saying that I get some contribution from here. This corresponds to particles which are in finite momentum state, thermally excited particles. So that plus particles in zero momentum state is equal to this. And this is calculated using this formula. So this is Einstein's.
Is V changing?
V? No. I'm considering an ensemble in which the volume is fixed. The number of particles is fixed. So small v, which is specific volume, it's fixed. It's
so
not changing with temperature.
Yeah, but if the particles are getting closer together, wouldn't they store a lesser volume in the phase space? Shouldn't we account for that?
No. Here, if you, in the, yeah, it's an important point. They are not condensing in the sense they are coming together in real space. Yeah. So if condensation were taking place like liquid gas, that's a different story. Here, it's an important point because this takes us to density-density correlation function. That is, you can take the Bose-Einstein gas and find out at a finite temperature. Suppose I consider a particle at this point. What is the probability I'll find another particle somewhere here? That has a very non-classical behavior. In fact, it has a form which looks like a critical behavior in some, as a, some kind of power law. So there are very interesting notions like boson bunching comes. Because bosons, here, you know the whole Bose-Einstein condensation phenomena is a tendency for bosons to be together in the same state. Here it happens to be a momentum state, a zero momentum state. Everybody is together there. But in real life, when you consider bosons, including photons at finite temperature and so on, you will find there is a tendency for bosons to be close by in real space. That's called boson bunching, which is a very important phenomena in Bose system. And as opposed to this, if you take a Fermi system, if you find a particle here and ask the question, what is the probability of finding another particle? There is a Pauli repulsion, so they will avoid each other. That's called a Fermi hole or a Pauli hole. So if you plot that, let me denote it by some F. It will have some form like this for fermions. That is, you will never find a fermion on top of another fermion unless you have spins which are different. So for spinless fermions, the distribution function without a physical repulsion among particles will have a hole. This is called Fermi hole. Whereas for the bosons, there is no such thing. In fact, there will be a kind of bunching, which people call it as boson bunching. So, yes?
So when you did this calculation, you assumed a grand canonical ensemble.
So I assumed a grand canonical ensemble, and then I look at the condition for determining chemical potential. So I'm not looking at the partition function. I am looking at an auxiliary condition, which is this, which tells me, in order to fix my chemical potential, I have to equate the total number of particles in all modes to be equal to capital N. So that's what I have been discussing. Then having discussed this, having found out mu as a function of t, I go back to partition function and substitute it there.
But when you're saying you have a grand canonical ensemble, how can you say that N is fixed?
No, N is fixed in the mean. See, when I go back to, okay, it's a very important point. So my grand partition function This is a definition of grand partition. So here there is no information about number of particles except through this fugacity. Now, if you look at this quantity as a probability distribution function, the probability of finding n particle in this distribution, here there is an n, here there is an n will be, it is picked around some mean value n naught. And that mean value will be determined by my chemical potential or fugacity. All this discussion is about finding that dependence. So having fixed the chemical potential or fugacity, I come back here and look at this distribution function, it will have a very short number, namely the number that is determined by that fugacity. So that's the spirit of grand Carnot. The same way, we allowed energy to fluctuate. Then you find that the mean energy is fixed at some value, which is the internal energy, and then there is very little fluctuation about it. That's it. Was there any other question? Okay. Yeah.
So when we do the DEC experiment,
yeah.
Do we give like some kind of particle reservoir contact with the system so that the number of particles is possible?
Okay, that's a very, again, a good question. So when we do BEC, typically what you do is you have some kind of trap which traps particles, so you have a cloud of condensate in a given volume. So at the moment, there is no reservoir, so this is everything, the particle number is fixed. But if I focus on a small volume, this is the spirit of Bose condensation, what you find is particle number coherently fluctuates in an anomalous fashion compared to a classical gas in this volume. So that is now, that is very difficult to see. So what you see is in Bose-Einstein condensate experiment, suppose you have a condensate cloud here and bring another condensate cloud here, bring them together, then this tendency to have coherent particle number fluctuation becomes more here. That is what is called, becomes more now, because I have a reservoir nearby. So bosons would like to go from here to here. Similarly, bosons would like to go from here to here. So depending on what is called the phase of these two condensate, you will have a spontaneous matter flow, which is related to Josephson current. If you're interested, I can explain it in detail. So this phenomenon of Bose coherence and a tendency to particles sit in the same zero momentum state can be seen if you look microscopically in subsystem. For example, in the case of superconductor, you can do tunneling. You can imagine the tunneling Cooper pairs and so on. In a Bose condensate, one simple thing that you can do is bring two condensates together, and then you will start seeing anomalous matter wave oscillations. That oscillation being determined by the relative chemical potential and the relative phase of the so-called order parameter. So there are very many beautiful phenomena following from this simple, simple-looking physics. Okay. So David, is that... If there is any question, I will be happy to answer. But yeah.
Here, we do not give any microscopic instruction on the particle, but still we are seeing some kind of phase transition behavior. So can we also characterize, like, is the BEC also have corresponding vertical equivalence and reversal?
Yeah. So in fact, the Nobel Prize winning experiments, so these cold atoms are essentially non-interactive. So what you do is you experimentally determine the Bose distribution function. See, I mentioned that in the case of ideal Bose gas, this will become plus zero because below TC minus one. So this is the expression for occupation number. So in particular, this says, suppose I shift the origin of momentum. So there is a delta function whose strength is n of t. then there is a tail, namely this, which is in fact diverging in a particular fashion as you go to zero momentum, as you can see from here. So below TC, a finite fraction of particles are here. The rest of the particles are in thermal state. Now this is for a system of infinite size. In a Bose-Einstein condensate experiment, what you have is you have a potential well. And then if you solve the problem of single particles, single bosons in this potential well, the ground state is a Gaussian state. So the bosons condense into this Gaussian state. So now, if you go to momentum space, this Gaussian will become not a delta function, it will become another Gaussian. So this is what you see experimentally. So you have Bose condensation, and then allow you to adiabatically expand and then do some photograph and so on. And then finally, you will see in this Nobel Prize article something like this. And because the Bose condensates are finite dimensional system, this it's not a delta function, but it's a Gaussian. Does that? Yeah, this is important because, but what is interesting is even though it is not an infinite system, this 1,000 particles or million particles already has fantastic Bose coherence phenomena. Okay, now we will go to this is what I wanted to do today, some exact statistical mechanics model and the transfer matrix method. So we have already seen what is two-dimensionalizing model. You take a simple square lattice and then say that there are spins sitting at every side which can take value plus or minus 1. So these spins communicate through each other through an interaction which is between neighbors. In particular, we look at a J which is positive. So these are convention. You see, take J positive and put negative. So this is a Hamiltonian. And now we have to solve statistical mechanics of this system. So we could solve this. So the number of states available when n is the number of spins is 2 to the power of n. So this is the dimension of my Hilbert space. So I have to do a statistical sum over this number of states. Or I could do microcanonical ensemble and count number of states as a function of energy. Anything will be fine. But it turns out, counting number of states, even Ansager could not do it. But he could use canonical ensemble and solve the problem. And so the canonical ensemble method is so this is a sum that we want to evaluate. So you have already seen that this sum over spins can be studied using a beautiful idea called a transfer matrix. You have already seen it in one dimension. You can think about this whole partition sum as an evaluation of trace of same set of operators. One operator, 2 by 2 matrices, some nth power of 2 by 2 matrices. So we will do this in detail. So this is what you have learned. And in particular, this trick works very well if you use periodic boundary condition. So we always, at the back of the mind, we use periodic boundary condition. Then the partition sum can be interpreted as some matrix so this S1 gets identified because I have a boundary condition. And in particular, this quantity, I'm always going to consider zero magnetic field. In one dimension, you can solve zero magnetic field plus a situation with magnetic field analytically. But in two dimension, you cannot do. So far, if one of you do it, it will be a great thing. It will fetch you several honors. So it's an outstanding problem how to calculate this, what Ansager left behind, namely Ising model in the presence of uniform magnetic field. So it's still an open problem, and many people have attempted, and it's worth thinking about. So this matrix, S1, E, S2, you think about S1. So the various values for this, then you have e to the power of beta j. When the spins are parallel. So this is a transfer matrix. So you have basically product of that. You take the product. And then you use a formula that this is basically trace of p to the power of n. And then this is particularly, if you can diagonalize this matrix, this is equal to lambda 1 to the power of n plus lambda 2 to the power of n. Because this matrix is two-dimensional, there are two eigenvalues. So this is something that you can immediately do for one-dimensional Ising model. And you can. Now if you think along the same way, you can very easily imagine that it's going to be complicated for two-dimensional because. So let me think about this. Suppose I consider a two-dimensional net in the form of a cylinder to begin with. So previously, I focused on one spin, then spin and its neighbor, and then wrote down what I have. Now I'm focusing on a chain. So I still have in mind a one-dimensional idea. That is, I look at all spins together along a chain and then form some matrix by considering all Boltzmann factors that connect spins in these plus neighbors. And then somehow try to diagonalize that particular matrix, P. Now, the dimension of that is going to be much larger because let me assume that the number of spins along a chain is M. So you will agree with me that if I think along this line, it's going to be a 2 to the power of m dimensional matrix. Because for if you think about this as an Ising chain, I have a transfer matrix which is two-dimensional. I have another identical variable, identical situation here. So there is another factor of 2 and so on. So I have 2 to the power of m, where is number, m is the number of sites along this chain. So it's going to be a huge matrix. The great success of Ansager was that he looked carefully into this matrix and he did several gymnastics and rewrote it and then finally found the eigenvalues of that giant matrix. The thermodynamic limits is a huge matrix. He made use of Clifford algebra, translation invariance, and a variety of things. So what I'm going to do now is to get this matrix explicitly for two dimension. And then think about it and solve it. So before that, let me again look at one dimension. And then let me assume there is a magnetic field. So if I look at the matrix P, that has, so I have, let me call this spin S and its neighbor S. Because the transfer matrix is going to connect a spin with a neighbor, or this spin with a neighbor. So let me call the spin as S and S prime. So minus beta J S S prime. That is, along the chain, I take the interaction. Yeah, here I take the interaction between the two spins and also a local magnetic field at this given site. So when I consider the next transfer matrix, this local magnetic field will appear. So this is just the, OK. Now I rewrite it as just for convenience. Now I'm going to say that this can be written as matrix V1 and V2. In particular, in the same language as before, in particular, I will say that this matrix V1 is, I'm just rewriting. This matrix V2 is simply e to the power of minus beta S temp delta S. So if you think about this as a left side index and this as a right side index, this is off diagonal in terms of these two indices, I and j. There are two indices. Whereas this is diagonal. So I am explicitly making it diagonal by putting this. So I have not done anything, I've just rewritten it. So I have rewritten this P operator in this language. Now I notice that this is a 2x2 matrix. And there is a theorem which says a 2x2 matrix can always be written as a sum of Pauli matrices. And this is going to be very useful for one-dimensional problem. It's not a great technique. Yes.
Are we considering a mean field from the other spins in H?
No. I'm doing an exact calculation. So, okay. So, this is what I'm supposed to do, right? So, let me. I'm focusing on one dimension. I'm going to do the full calculation. Now, I try to do it in a clever way by rewriting as a product over identical matrices, and then taking a trace. Now, I'm discussing property of that matrix.
H is an external magnetic field,
not a self-consistent field. So it's something that I put by hand. In the lab, I apply a magnetic field, and that's H. So now, for later convenience, in order to solve the two-dimensional problem, it is convenient for me to rewrite this in terms of Pauli spin operator. Let me digress a little bit and talk about Pauli spin operators. So you have learned that if you consider two-dimensional matrix, you have this identity matrix. Sigma x, sigma z, sigma y will be minus I. So they satisfy the algebra that sigma alpha commutation relation is a well-known commutation relation of Pauli. You can very easily see by substitute. So then you have this identity matrix. In some sense, these things form a complete set. So any two-dimensional matrix can be written like this. Now, we have this matrix V1. So this essentially becomes identity times e to the power of minus beta j plus e to the power of beta j sigma x. This is easy to see because the diagonal elements are identical. So I just take that out, e to the power of minus beta j times identity matrix. The off diagonal elements, it should be 1, 1. The off diagonal elements, e to the power of beta j and e to the power of beta j. So now, in the same language, can write V2 in a much simpler way as minus beta h sigma z. You can just look at the matrix element, you will get basically what I wrote there. Now what I would like to do is, I would like to, since V2 is appearing as exponential of an operator, I would like to exponentiate this. It's very simple. When you do that, you just get this following result. It's straightforward algebra. That you can, this matrix can be rewritten as square root of where theta is defined by tan hyperbolic. Okay. So I have, you know, if you look at it, this will give you basically this alone exponential of theta times. Because suppose I take this exponential and expand it in powers. And remember that sigma x square is 1. Sigma x cube equals sigma x itself. That's a property of polymatrices. Square of any component of the polymatrix is 1. So this separates half of this expansion into cos hyperbolic and the odd part into sine hyperbolic, and you have this. So which are you, when you compare with this, and you get this formula. It's a fairly straightforward algebra. So when you do this, you get basically V1 equals square root of 2 e to the power of theta. So what have I done? I have just rewritten the familiar transfer matrix, which I can diagonalize and solve the problem in terms of some Pauli operators for later convenience. Okay. Now, with this in mind, let me go to two dimension. A two dimension, as I did before, if I if I look at the partition function, this will involve, a typical term will involve S, let's say, let me call this as the lth row, and all spins in that row, that is spin 1, 2, up to SLM, all spin along this line. And then here, the next row, L plus 1th row, and all spins, that is, in the as I walk up the column, 1, L plus 1, 2, L plus 1, 3, and so on. So this is how, and this particularly has a very simple form, exponential of minus beta j, I have s l plus 1, that is, it connects this and this with an index k which runs from 1 to m. So this index k counts where I am along this chain. And the first index counts where I am along this chain. So if I have a magnetic field, I can put a magnetic field so I've just taken part of the Boltzmann factor, all interactions in this chain, and the interaction between spins in this chain and the neighboring chain. So when I consider this chain, I will take the magnetic field there. So this simply contains, so it's like a comb. I have all interaction term here, including magnetic field, then interaction between one chain and another chain. Then I will consider the next spin. So this is what, now I would like to give a representation for this in terms of spin operator.
You're only considering the interaction between two different
neighboring chains.
So we're not considering the interaction among the in between the spins in the same L.
Yeah. This is what I, so I pick up one chain. And this chain contains interaction between the chain, which is what I, which is this. Sorry, the, yeah. I but thanks for the meaning. I forgot that. So that should be SL. This will contain, yeah. Yes. So this is the interaction between the L chain and its neighbor. And this is the interaction. So as before, we ignore magnetic field term because we can't deal with it. Now this contains, so in some sense this is like the diagonal term, because this doesn't contain take a chain from the another chain. So it contains interaction within the same chain. So when you do this mapping, exactly when I did for one dimension, you get a very simple result. I will elaborate on that. But this matrix, so now I call this as V1. So V1 will be and V2 will be now, since I'm just focused on one transfer matrix, I remember that this is one chain and its neighbor. I will ignore this index L. And instead call it as S prime. So basically, S says, this says that I have a connection between spin in one chain and the neighboring chain. The same level, which I do not make here, and that goes from K to N. Yeah. Whereas as far as B2 is concerned, it couples spins along the same chain. So S goes to S. And it contains S and S, but at different heights. This contains at the same height two neighboring spins. So if I were to write down now this in terms of operator, you can imagine that this will be off tag. Because sigma S and S prime, this is S and S. And the result is very simple. Please think about it. It's exactly as before. The off-diagonal term, this changes, and what you find is V1 becomes V to the power of theta. This is a central result. I have not done anything. I have simply expressed the partition function as product over big operator. This matrix is a big matrix. Its dimension is 2 to the power of m, where is m is the number of spins in a given chain or column. And I have a product over all such chains. And as in one dimension, I use the result that this product can be written as trace of some big number of m. So I'm interested in finding the eigenvalue of that matrix P. Now the matrix P has a large dimension, 2 to the power of r. Now, instead of explicitly writing in this basis, I go to this 2 to the power of n dimensional matrix, which contains direct product of Pauli matrices corresponding to each degree of freedom. And then this becomes now the off-diagonal term, that is the term that connects, that transfers information about spin from one chain to another chain at the same height, becomes off-diagonal. And this beta j, so the same thing that we had before, just using this trick. It is a direct product of operators like this for every side. So each one of them, I can write it in terms of x component of Pauli spin, which can be rewritten identically like this. So, which is this. This is nothing but. So I simply use this, the off diagonal term for every side, as sigma s. So notice an interesting thing, that original transfer matrix written in terms of this operator contains a single Pauli operator and summed over all sides along the chain, and within the chain you have this. So b1, b2 is our matrix that we want to diagonalize, is e to the power of theta. So this is a challenge that Ansager faced and which he solved. So I have to diagonalize this matrix. Now it starts reminding you of something like e to the power of some delta c times hamilton. Yes,
here. Like in the previous example, you wrote it down the V1 equal to the e to the eta times sigma x.
Which one?
I mean here, V1 is equal to the eventually square root of dot 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 exponential eta times sigma x, but here you wrote it down in terms of sigma z. So.
Okay, this
step?
Oh, sorry,
V1.
V1. So I had sigma x.
Yeah, but in there, you wrote it down in terms of sigma z.
Thank you.
For V2,
yeah.
Sigma k, you wrote it down as sum of sigma kz times sigma kz, which is equal to 1. But I think it is not true. Like, I think sigma k plus 1.
Thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, otherwise it becomes trivial. Yeah, so this is the way. The big transfer matrix gets a very beautiful form in terms of Pauli spin operators, which are defined at every side along this chain. Now I'm just pointing out that this looks like exponential of some Hamiltonian operator, which is acting in some small time interval. And you can imagine the entire thing in the language of path integral, that is, you start with some initial state, you evolve it in time by some Hamiltonian. And then it will take you through all possible intermediate states and you sum over. So, in fact, we will see later, there is a beautiful path integral representation for a one-dimensional quantum spin problem, which gives us this two-dimensional IC model partition function. And what Ansager did was to go from a two-dimensional classical partition function into finding some Hermitian operator, which he diagonalized. And it is later people like Lipschitz and Mathis connected answer whatever Ansager did in terms of solving a one-dimensional quantum problem. And this time evolution in along this direction is like time evolution in Euclidean time direction. So e to the power of I h t, you have e to the power of minus some beta x. So all those things we will see later. But at the moment, if I find the eigenvalues of this
then it will be very easy.
So now let me, in order to solve this, Lieb, Schultz, and Mattis used a very beautiful method, which is the Jordan-Weidman transformation. So if you stare at it for a while, this and this, they don't commute, because there is x component and there is z component. And you can try to use the famous Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. So you have E to the power. Plus half of plus commutation of this x plus commutation of number, I can't remember, and so on. Even that doesn't work obviously. I would like, but you know, suppose this works, then what I will have is, instead of having two product of two exponentials, I will have an exponential of beta sigma k x minus beta j sigma k even this is a non-trivial operation to solve. Because now if I look at it, this looks like a quantum problem. In particular, since I do the chain like this, I have a chain in which some spins are living. Now these spins are, I have denoted by sigma. And there is a components coupled along this direction. And they also experience a magnetic field, so theta, but in the wrong direction, the x direction. So it's not like the standardizing model in which the interaction occurs between same components of the spin as the magnetic field. So in the standardizing model, you will have J I Z plus H. So there is no commutation problem. Here you have a, you have landed at, you started with the two-dimensional classical system problem. You rewrote it in terms of transfer matrices. And then now you are landed in some effective, some operator, which looks like a quantum spin chain. These quantum spin chains, because this and this do not commute, and you started, whereas this would have been a classical spin. Now it is this which you want to solve, which was solved by David Schultz and Mattis, and this is called quantum spin chain. And this is a very beautiful model which is exactly solvable in terms of fermions, which is what we will see in great detail in the rest of the time and tomorrow. And then it will give us Ansager's partition function. So I will finish today with defining Jordan-Weidman transformation, which is going to help us solve this problem. So Jordan and Winter asked the question that suppose I have a collection of holy spin operators, or physical spin on a chain. There is something about this object. It's like the Fermi system in the sense I can have either up spin or down spin. So I can imagine at the back of the mind this to be a state in which there is zero particle, and this is a zero particle. This is a state in which there is one particle. So you call it as some hardcore particle. You cannot have more than one spin, or in other words, can have a zero occupancy or occupancy one, that's it, not occupancy two and so on. Further, if you look at the commutation relation of these Pauli spin operators, they commute and they are a different set. So that means these objects, actually bosons, when they are a different set, they commute. But on the same side, they behave like fermions, because they exclude each other. So they attempted to put this together in a form which is captured by an equivalent fermion. Because the Hilbert space of such a system is two-dimensional, 2 to the power of n. And imagine you have fermions hopping on this layer. The Hilbert space also is as well as it's two-dimensional, 2 to the power of n. But I have to make them anti-communal. So I don't know how they landed at this trick. They define now, so their statement is correct. You give me this Pauli spin operator, I will construct fermions for you by the following method. They said that. So for this, it's good to start with open chain, so on. So let me take the product of, I keep changing sigma, pardon me, but that's right. So I take a string of z until the site I am interested in. Since I have a string going up to the end, and then multiply it by sigma I. I define an operator. So if I had no string, they commute by definition. But you will find that when they have string, they in fact start anti-commuting. You can explicitly show that, since I don't have time, I can't do it. Basically, substitute for this. So let me assume that j is to the right of I. Then what you will find is, as you commute this big object, so it's not a local object. See, originally, if this were alone, it would have been a local object. This is a non-local object. As I commute, commutation amounts to passing each. So the one fellow will cross the string of that. So in the process, you will get a minus n. It's as simple as that. So that's what makes it anti-commutative. Please do it yourself and enjoy. It's very simple. Now there exists an inverse transformation also. Equivalent, we can write this as C I dagger. If the number of data. So this is an inverse function. So you give me fermions on a lattice in one dimension. These fermions don't carry spin index or any additional flavor index. If you take this fermion and multiply it by a string operator, and you notice now this is very interesting. Because if you take a typical term, some number of it, right? So their phase can be plus or minus 1. So it's similar related to this. So somehow this phase takes care of it. I just want to point out the digression that actually turns out you can do it in higher dimension also, like 2 or 3 dimension, which is intimately related to Chern's Engel theory and so on, flux attachment trick. But this is the trick Wigner invented many decades ago. And this helped Schultz and Matisse to diagonalize this matrix, diagonalize this matrix. So let me indicate what is the thing. So I have here given a representation in which I am connecting sigma S plus with C operator. So in order to do this, I will simply rewrite that. And you think about it, this won't change the physics. I change the direction of quantization and write it as X I simply start calling z axis as x axis, and this is a non-commuting thing. So I call z axis as x axis, and x axis as z axis. Then it's consistent with the convention that people know. Now, if you take that definition and then substitute for sigma x in terms of this,
sigma x is sigma I plus is a standard deviation. Some remarkable things happen. Because you expect that, you know, suppose you take sigma I x, sigma I plus x. So this, when you substitute this fellow, firstly you can radiate it as sigma I x plus sigma I plus hermitian. I'm simply rewriting it in terms of sigma plus and sigma. And then if I substitute for this in terms of this Jordan-Wigner transformation, you will worry about the tail. Because this operator will carry a long tail, this operator will carry a long tail. And what will happen is they will consume each other. And finally, you will be left with, I will write down the result and then we will discuss it in detail. Sorry, it may not be visible to others, I think. So at the end of the day, the Jordan-Wigner matrix transforms this term that I'm talking about. Into something very neat, which is in terms of this Jordan-Wigner fermions. Without any tape. So, because this definition looks scary, because I have this phase factor. Some of the phase factors organize themselves, I will show it explicitly in the next class, and gives you the combination of fermion operator C dagger plus C, and another combination, the plus and for neighboring set. And then the magnetic field term, by its very definition, is simple because if I carry on this definition of Jordan-Wigner fermion, magnetic field becomes minus 1. Suitable. Okay. So it's either plus, the occupation number is 1, sigma z is 1. The occupation number is 0 is minus 1. So this becomes simply plus constant. I will show this explicitly tomorrow. So diagonalizing the transfer matrix or the log of the transfer, that is, you write the transfer matrix as an exponential of some operator, and if you diagonalize that operator, it's as good as diagonalizing exponential of that operator. That through the Jordan-Wigner trick becomes like a problem of fermions hopping on a lattice. And I'm sure you have come across in the quantum mechanics in solid state theory. This problem is solved because I have free fermions. Except that there is a peculiarity about this fermion. Normally, when I study fermions, they hop from one side to another side. This is what you learn in tight binding model and so on. Here, there is the so-called anomalous term, which is not hopping but pair creation. That is very expanded. You find that fermions do hop, but there is also a probability that at a given neighboring site, spontaneously two fermions can appear and disappear. So it's a very peculiar problem. And if you have come across superconductivity BCS theory, indeed, such phenomena occurs there. Spontaneous creation of pairs from condensate. So there is also a very beautiful mathematical connection to BCS theory. Then we will see that tomorrow that this problem can be diagonalized by Fourier transformation and another thing called Gogolyubov transformation, and we can get exact creation. I think I will stop this today. So let me summarize what we did today. We started with Ising model. We had a quick look at the transfer matrix method for 1D Ising model. where the dimension of transfer matrix is 2 by 2. And those transfer matrices can be written in terms of some Pauli spin operator. Please remember that this Pauli spin operator is different from what you started with as spins on the side. This is the mathematical way of rewriting this thermal Boltzmann factor appearing as a 2 by 2 matrix in terms of Pauli spin matrices. That's why I have denoted them by sigma. So in particular, there were two matrices, V1 and V2. So V1 talked about communication between a site and a spin with a neighbor. And in that case, V2 is communication on the same site, namely with a magnetic field. So what is off-diagonal when you consider a site and its neighbor becomes the x component of the spin. And what is diagonal continues to be, it has just z component of the field. Then we generalize it to two dimension, in which you have several identical chains running forward like this. But however, and corresponding to each of them, you have a 2 by 2 matrix. So your full problem is a direct product of several 2 by 2 matrices, the Hilbert space dimension 2 to the power of n. And there is a new term, which is the connection between this and this, which looks diagonal. And then there is a term which connects the site with the neighbor in the horizontal direction. And that becomes off diagonal, which is what I mean. So this is an important point. So a big transfer matrix in this basis of Pauli spin operator has a very neat form looking like this. So there's a transverse component and the longitudinal component. They don't commute. So now the problem is diagonalism. So I pointed out that Jordan-Winter transformation is going to help us. Indicated what is Jordan-Winter transformation. That is, they consider a collection of spin operators in the chain, Pauli spin operator. And they recognize some similarity to fermion problem in the sense there is a hot core repulsion or a Pauli exclusion, but a different size they commute. So they said you can recover or you can generate anti-commutation relation by considering composite operators, which contains simple spin free times a string, which is on the left. And then lo and behold, they start anti-commutation. And the Hamiltonian that which you are interested in studying becomes very simple in this hand. Incidentally, when you people do conformal field theory, you will come across vertex operators. You'll come across Mandelstam operator and so on. They are basically these expressed in continuum line. So this is a simplest way to understand those aspects starting from the line. Thank you. You have any questions?
Maybe I have more general questions. So in classical mechanics, there is like a concept of complete integrability, which tells me I can actually integrate a system. So is there something similar here for statistics?
Yes. So in terms of the transfer matrix that I have got here and the corresponding Hamiltonian that we are discussing is completely integrable in the case of Ising model. So in some sense, Ansager discovered one of the first completely integrable spin chain. So this is one simple example. There are completely integrable spin chains which corresponds to so-called XXZ model or Heisenberg model, solved by Bethe.
So does it mean that I have like an infinite set of integrals of motion? Or?
I do.
Yeah.
In fact, we will see that. So once we diagonalize this problem in momentum space, we will find basically, every normal mode in K space is a conserved particle. So, in a very simple way, in a very trivial way, infinite set of conserved quantities is called.
Yes. There we have like E1 and E2, and then we write it in terms of just one like exponential. But like as you wrote, like there should be some commutators between the two terms, but why?
Right. So I did not elaborate on that. I could use formula, but it turns out the way Lipschultz and Matrix does, they do. It's not necessary to do that. You can just play with this product of two exponential operators and solve the problem.
We're saying that we can map this to that exponential.
Exactly.
That equivalent, but not the same.
It turns out when you do the way that I was doing, I ignored this commutation relation. You get some boundary terms, which in the thermodynamic limit are negligible. So knowing that, I'm doing it. If you do it rigorously, this going from here to e to the power of x plus iy and throwing away looks like a big problem.
Yeah.
But finally, it's not. So I'm assuming that and I'm doing it. But tomorrow, I will just play with this without Baker-Campbell formula. So this can be, in fact, that is the way Lipschultz and Matrix perform analysis. And you can get all the similarities and the critical exponents of fine-sim modeling. You get log of t minus tc, the specific t, and magnetization at the critical point as a function of magnetic field going as to the power of 1 over 8, and all those things you can get. And then even the exponent of theta, anomalous dimension. Yes?
At each site in that diagram, the spin is interacting with the spin above it, right?
Correct.
But you're saying that you can take the matrix for one row and just take the direct product?
Precisely, yeah, exactly. I glossed over that because. So now.
How will the interaction turn out?
So, in fact, this is discussed in great detail. Yeah, we should give a reference. There is a. There is a review article, Reviews of Modern Physics, by Lee If you just do a Google, you will find somebody has downloaded it. It's there in some journal. And there, what I did not explain in detail, how you go from, in a single chain, you have to go to many. Now, when you go to many chains, you have 2x2 matrices for each chain. So putting them together amounts to building the Hilbert space of direct products. So that mathematics I did not explain. It's explained in detail in this, as well as in books like Statistical Mechanics, Person Huang. Yeah, I took it for granted, but please have a look at this.
And the fermion hopping part, is it given in that same book?
No, I will do that. Yeah, fermion hopping part, it is, I think the best place is this. Review article now, review support.
Because the notation is a little unclear. I mean, like.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I keep.
What denotes a sigma matrix? Then you have C's or something like that.
Well, so, the question is about this notation. So I have been consistent, I think, going from one dimension to two dimension. In one dimension, I had a sigma x and sigma y at a given side. Here I have a sigma x and sigma y at all sides along a chain. Okay. So far, so good.
Yeah.
Now, your question is, what is C, right?
Yeah.
That is the Jordan Fermion. So I have operators which contains z components of polyspin and x components of polyspin. Now I would like to convert them into something else, which is solvable. So Lipschultz and Wigner found that if you follow Jordan-Wigner tree and construct fermions using this polyspin operator, this construction is exact. And it turns out that horrible looking operator, difficult operator, becomes solvable. It becomes free from.
So in the anti-commutation relation, you have Ci diagonal Cj.
Yeah, Cj. Exactly. But in the creation and degree, this is a standard anti-commutation relation for fermions. And when you do anti-commutation, you'll have to push one b to the other. On the way, everything will go through except one, which has a common sign, that will be an extra sign, which is one. Please enjoy it with that. Any other questions? I'm sure you are feeling hungry. I'm also feeling hungry.